rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Robert M. Davis presiding. All have business before this court, draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I am Chief Judge Davis. To my right are Judges Sholin, Bartley, Allen, and Toth. To my left are Judges Peach, Greenberg, Meredith, and Falvey. We are here today in the matter of Victor Score against Robert Wilkie, docket number 17-2574. We're here to consider whether the court should entertain class actions in the appeal context. Should the court use Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 23 as a guide in determining whether to certify a class action? Should the proposed class be certified? And does the court have jurisdiction to certify a class where some members of the proposed class do not have a final board decision? Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Good morning, Mr. Chief Judge and judges of the court. Michael Wisheny, Veterans Legal Services Clinic, Yale Law School. With me today are law student interns Corey Meyer, who will present the opening, and Megan Brooks, who will present the rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mark Vigich from the Department of Veterans Affairs. With me today is Kate Hogan and Rich Daly, also from the General Counsel's Office of the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Thank you all. I understand that Mr. Score is in attendance as well. Is that correct, Mr. Wisheny?
Yes.
Sir, welcome here. Thank you. This is a historic oral argument because we just issued a decision in Monk that indicated our willingness to hear class actions, certify class actions in the petition context, and today we're considering that question in the appeals context. So welcome to being a part of history today. Are the parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Each party will have 60 minutes to present your respective arguments. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. We'd like to reserve 20 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, very well. You may proceed.
May it please the court, Corey Meyer, law student intern for appellant Victor Score, on behalf of himself and a proposed class of Palomares veterans. Today, appellant Score presents three core points. First, this court has the authority and power vested in it by Congress to hear class actions arising from claims for benefits. The power to certify class actions was recognized by the Federal Circuit and Monk v. Shulkin and emerges from the court's powers under the All Writs Act, under statute, and the court's inherent powers. Moreover, this court has jurisdiction to certify a class whose definition includes persons who have been or will be injured by defendants, by secretaries' unlawful conduct.
Mr. Meyer, how do you get to the will be injured part? Our statute certainly says we have jurisdiction to hear cases where there is a final board decision. And what if there is no final board decision? It sounds like your class, based on my reading of the papers, would be a little bit broader than that.
Your Honor, the All Writs Act gives this court authority in aid of its prospective jurisdiction, where there could eventually be a board decision in a matter, this court can have jurisdiction.
But we also have a limitation under the All Writs Act, even assuming it applies in the context of an appeal as well, that it can't be a substitute for an appeal. If any of those individual veterans or family members who have not yet received a final board decision could appeal to this court, why would we intervene prior to that juncture?
Your Honor, this question raises many important points. And one thing I want to say at the outset to distinguish this from some characterizations of the class is that this court is not taking jurisdiction over the underlying claims for benefits that are either presently before the Secretary or will be before the Secretary. Now, the reason why a class action is needed in this type of context is threefold. First, a class action will provide consistency and implementation in the relief offered by the court in this matter. In at least one instance in Stout, the case, the Secretary failed to implement the relief for 2 years. By certifying a class and overseeing and monitoring the relief in this case, this court can ensure that the relief it orders is effectuated.
What case was that? That took them 2 years to implement.
Stab, S-C-A.
Thank you.
Welcome, Your Honor. Second, a class action provides fairness in
reason. Well, let me ask you, if I may, what if the court approached this as a matter of constitutional dimension, putting aside the All Writs Act? Don't we have the power under the Constitution to issue any order that will effectuate the purposes of congressional action with regard to veterans? Isn't our power unlimited except parties may appeal to a higher court? Don't you agree with that?
It is correct, Your Honor, that this court can harness its inherent powers.
So, assuming we don't go that far, what about an order in this particular case that cures the situation, at least from my standpoint, we found in Staub, where we order the Secretary to put out the word to all the world what the decision of the court is on the merits? Doesn't that accomplish pretty much what a class action would?
Your Honor, that is another core feature of a class action that would provide benefits.
But would you agree that even apart from class action, we could order that remedy, the method of notice to the world of what we decided on the merits?
That is correct, Your Honor. The second reason a class action is crucial is that it will provide fairness in re-adjudication of those claims that have been erroneously denied by the Secretary. As in past veterans' class actions, which predate the creation of this court, claims were ordered to be re-adjudicated in the relief in those class actions.
Mr. Meyer, can I ask you a question about it may go to jurisdiction and it may not. In this case, it appears that Mr. Skor expressly made before the board and the RO the same claims that are at the core of the class relief here under 3.09 and 3.311. and he did so on at least two occasions, maybe more, and not obliquely, quite directly. And my reading of the board decision is the board simply didn't address that in any respect at all. What impact, if any, does that have on what we should do with respect to the certification of the class, in your view? And just as a heads up, I'm going to ask exactly the same question to the Secretary because I really don't know what the answer is.
It is correct, Your Honor, that Mr. Score raised the legal claims before the BDA and the RO in several instances. In terms of what this means for the class action, this means that at the very least, the VA has already had the opportunity to respond to those claims below and has not offered any response to the claim that the exclusion of Palomares from 3309 is arbitrary and capricious, and that the dosimetry methodology relied on under 3311 is also arbitrary and capricious or unreliable and unlawful. And that means that for this class and this court, the opportunity to address those legal claims is here. And it points to perhaps either an unwillingness or inability of the BVA and regional offices to address the types of legal claims that are now before this court.
So, hypothetically, what if we determined that we have jurisdiction to exercise a class action over people who don't have a final board decision, just assume we rule that way, and that we also have the discretion to reach out and answer these, address these questions in the first instance, but it's not a mandatory thing. What would you say if we decided to retain jurisdiction over this matter and remand to the board to address the arguments in the first instance?
A remand is not advisable for many reasons, the least of which being delay, and the second of which being it's unclear if the BVA could or would ever rule that a regulation is arbitrary and capricious.
So let me ask you this. Because this is important.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are your claims that the regulations themselves are arbitrary and capricious? I understood, for example, your second one under 3.311 to actually be that the methodology is arbitrary and capricious, not that the regulation is. Are you asking the board to strike down the regulations or us?
It is correct, Your Honor. On 311, the contention of arbitrary and capricious is related to the methodology. Also, it is worth pointing out that under 3309, there is a challenge both to the regulation and the interpretation of that regulation to exclude Palomares.
With regard to the 3309 argument about the regulation, there is authority for petitioning for rulemaking to the Federal Circuit. Why would that not be a better mechanism to address this issue than a direct appeal to this court?
Because the petition for rulemaking would not solve Mr. Score's claims as the regulations as applied to him and as applied to all Palomares veterans are arbitrary and capricious. It is possible that rulemaking could lead to the recognition of Palomares, which would take years. Mr. Score would wait perhaps 3 years for a decision by the VA, and if they decline to include Palomares in 3309, then he would have to go to the Fed Circuit for lengthy litigation. This court was created by Congress to address issues of this sort, to ask veterans to take it upon themselves to petition for rulemaking and fight in the Federal Circuit if the rulemaking does not come out in their favor is a huge, huge ask for the veterans of this nation.
Mr. Meyer, how many members in the class are there?
Your Honor, we are not certain the number of members of this class. It is up to the 1,600 veterans who served at Palomares, Spain, and we are aware of a number of BVA decisions, and there are certainly other decisions at the RO level which were not appealed.
Do you have any updates since the figures that is in the material from 2013 regarding numbers?
Your Honor, we do not have those numbers. In this case, the Secretary is best suited to know details surrounding numerosity.
What is your best guess on numerosity?
Your Honor, it would be guessing to establish any number, but it is worth pointing out that the legal standards where common sense dictates that the numerosity threshold has been met, the precise number is not necessary. Moreover, in future harm class actions, there is always uncertainty as to the number of members in that class, but this does not stop district courts from certifying classes involving future harm.
Could you say for certain that it's not over 1,600 at this point?
Certainly our class, because there were a maximum of 1,600 individuals at Palomares, that would be an upper limit.
Could I get back to the point that Judge Allen raised? Are you asking us in the first instance to determine whether a scientific methodology is sound? And how could we do that without any impermissible fact-finding or weighing of evidence? And you also attached to your brief a number of studies that were not in the record of proceedings that you want us to look at. How could we do that given our statutory constraints?
Your Honor, sound scientific evidence is a legal standard supplied in the regulations. The Labatt-Anderson report is so unbelievably below that level, that standard, that this court can rule that that report, which supplied the doses applied in Mr. Score's case and to all Palomares veterans, is not sound scientific medical evidence. For example, that report excludes in multiple times the highest dose level exposures. That report says this is a preliminary analysis. Moreover, that report says further testing is necessary.
And all of this, though, assuming we can look at those reports and compare them to the other reports you've attached to your briefs, it's your view that this does not involve any fact-finding or weighing evidence to come up with whether or not this process is scientifically sound?
Your Honor, it would not involve weighing evidence, because on its face, this report is unsound.
If we were to determine that we are not able to provide the relief that you're seeking, so say one way or another whether or not the scientific process is sound, how does it impact the class? Do we even need to be able to grant relief on the merits to this named petitioner or appellant before we would consider certifying?
Your Honor, if this court sees fit to certify a class at the relief stage, it is well within its powers to do so, but because the Labatt-Anderson report, which has been submitted to the VA through class members' claims, provides the essential common challenge that these class members bring, it can and should be considered by this court.
But if we came out where Judge Allen said if we need to remand for the board to decide that in the first instance, how does that impact whether or not we should certify a class on that question?
If this court decides a remand is necessary, it could certify the class and await determination on remand and then continue those issues once the findings are made by the BVA. And I want to clarify.
Well, wait a minute. Couldn't we certify a class, appoint a special master to do all of these things that the suggested remand would do?
It would be efficiently,
more quickly?
It would be within this court's powers and within the well-understood powers of courts to appoint special master.
And that's not fact-finding. That's an interpretation of facts made below, which we have the power to do, is it not?
That is correct, Your Honor.
What facts were found below on the issue of the scientific soundness of this process?
Because the Secretary adopted these doses, the factual determination was that these doses are reliable and sound scientific medical evidence. It would be unbelievable if the Secretary would ever say, we have adopted these doses, but they are not sound scientific medical evidence.
I I'd like to get back to a question that Judge Sholin asked earlier, and that is this relationship between Mr. Score filed an appeal here, but in your class certification document, request for class certification, you cite to the All Writs Act. What? Just tell me, like, how is that working here? How do you anticipate that those two work in conjunction with each other in this matter?
Your Honor, the All Writs Act is regularly used when claims are brought under one statute or regulation to provide authority for courts in aid of their prospective jurisdiction. The underlying case need not be for a writ in order to draw on the authorities granted to this court under the All Writs Act.
And so it was very unclear in your submissions. Are you suggesting something like in Yamasaki, where the court, as I understand it, used the All Writs Act for jurisdiction, and that was jurisdiction over the class after the suit had been filed? So there was an appeal, a suit, and there was also use of the All Writs Act kind of in conjunction with the appeal? Is that what you're envisioning, or something else?
That is correct, Your Honor. The All Writs Act, in addition to this court's statutory powers to create rules and this court's inherent powers, can be drawn on to certify a class involving the legal claims of all class members.
To just follow up on that, just assume hypothetically that one of us is going to have to write something down, okay? And I understand why you're giving the answer you have given, right, which is there's the All Writs Act and there's the inherent power and there's the rulemaking, right? Assume that we're going to say there is jurisdiction to do what you're asking us to do because, and give me precisely what the answer is, not, well, you could do it under the All Writs Act or your inherent power. I mean, what is your best argument for why there is jurisdiction to do what you're asking us to do?
Your Honor, this court's jurisdiction comes from 7252A, and the All Writs Act provides authority that this court can use in aid of its prospective jurisdiction under 7252A. Because the legal claims of all class members could be brought on the basis of their claims which have been denied or will be denied below, then...
So is it fair to say that step one of your argument is Mr. Score has a final board decision, therefore the court has jurisdiction under 7252A over Mr. Score's claim? At that point, the jurisdictional light switch has been turned on. Now the court can use the All Writs Act to effectively certify the class because we're not ruling on the benefits claims ultimately for each of those class members. We are simply answering a question relevant to Mr. Score's appeal over which we have jurisdiction. The answer to that question can then be plugged in to each of the other claims. Might be dispositive in some, it might be irrelevant in the others. But that would that be a good description of what you're saying?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Mr. Meyer, why wouldn't a precedential decision of this court achieve the same end?
Your Honor, for the reasons that I've already given regarding the consistency and implementation, second is the fairness in re-adjudication, and the third point, which I have not yet gotten to, would be the access to justice. Along these lines includes Judge Greenberg's point about notice to all class members that the law governing their claims or potential claims has changed. In addition, not all veterans have the resources and capacity to bring complex legal challenges of this nature. A class action permits their claim, their legal issues, to be heard before this court.
Okay. I'm sorry. I have two questions relating to that. First, if, assuming all you're saying is true, which I agree with, wouldn't that apply in every single instance? And the difference that a regular class action has before a district court is it doesn't have a binding effect upon the next person who comes in the door and the next person who comes in the door. Our court, being an appellate court, is, to quote a legal scholar, a platypus, and we have this authority to issue presidential decisions. So the applicability of our decisions would apply to every veteran who is similarly situated. So why isn't your argument then that every case before this court should be a class action, or perhaps none of them should be because we have presidential authority?
And for one example, goes back to the Staub case, which I mentioned earlier, is that a class action is the surest way to ensure that the relief in this case is effectuated.
Again,
in terms of
how does this case make it be unique as compared with every other? This court issues 60, 80, whatever presidential decisions a year this year. We're not issuing 80 class actions. We're presuming the secretary is going to abide by this court's decisions in good faith. What makes your case unique?
This case is unique in that the legal claims being brought here satisfy the requirements of Rule 23, and that the relief granted would apply equally to all class members. Many cases that this court decides involves very minor factual details which get at the hearts of the claims, but this claim is, and the claims brought on behalf of the class, are of a nature which would impact all class members.
So your answer is this should be a class because it satisfies the requirements for class?
My answer of why this should be a class includes certainly that it does satisfy the requirements of Rule 23, but also that there are core benefits to a class action that involve re-adjudication and the access to justice, which includes notice, and that this court will have greater authority in overseeing the implementation of this decision. The recourse to justice under a class action is more rapid than waiting 2 years and then bringing another challenge. Because the veterans in this particular class are in their 70s and 80s, class action is absolutely necessary for many of them to see relief in their lifetimes. And that's.
So you see, if we were to certify a class and decide the way that your client advocates, that VA would adjudicate the claims of veterans whose claims are pending below in a more expeditious manner than other veterans who may be ahead of them in the litigation queue?
First of all, not only the claims pending below, but also those that have already been denied will be re-adjudicated sooner. It's not clear that the VA would be under any obligation of this class action to expedite the processing of the claims that are currently pending below, but the relief ordered by this court can ensure that regardless of where those pending claims are in the process, that the relief ordered is effectuated in those pending claims prior to their resolution.
And one last matter, you mentioned notice. This court doesn't have rules yet on how to administer class actions. We've said we would borrow from Rule 23 as applicable and necessary. The types of cases that generally would be before a court, and this one, are sort of more of a injunctive type relief case where notice is not required. So would you be advocating that there would be notice
in terms of
the class members?
Your Honor, in terms of the notice, appellant presents would be notice of the relief ordered at the end of the case. And because that relief would impact the claims that might be brought, notice is the surest way to ensure that everyone is aware that the law governing their claim has changed. Other forms of notice involve usually at the certification stage.
And in other types of cases, the parties would pay for such notice. In this instance, who would you be advocating would cover the cost of such notice?
And in this case, because the notice would be part of the relief and accompanying the relief, we would advise that the VA would bear the cost of notice.
Thank you.
Mr. Meyer, would your class include potential members who have not filed a claim before the board?
Your Honor, the class does involve individuals who have not filed an appeal to the BVA.
Could I ask you two substantive questions that would go if we get down the road to try to certify on each of these two claims? So starting first with the one under 3.309, what precisely does Mr. Score get if Palomares is listed as a radiation risk activity?
Mr. Score, first of all, would get the curing of his legal injury because he's a participant at Palomares. But second of all, well, most importantly...
Let's stop at okay. The first one.
So Mr. Score...
Explain that to me.
So Mr. Score's legal injury service arising because of the exclusion of Palomares, the event that he served at, from 3309.
But that's a totally abstract... That's sort of like it would make him feel better that it's listed on this list. What does he get?
And secondly, he gets to participate in the ionizing radiation registry program.
And okay, that's what I thought you'd say. What precisely do you get when you participate in the IRR?
The IRR involves a set of health screening benefits designed for those veterans exposed to ionizing radiation. Interestingly, this is also a scientific registry that keeps track of the types of conditions suffered by veterans exposed to radiation. That is can provide huge benefits because of the lack of knowledge surrounding exposures to radiation.
Doesn't it also provide treatment for things that are potentially related to ionizing radiation exposure?
The exact contours of treatment aren't very certain because it involves the health screening, and potentially if that health screening were to indicate that there is a radiogenic condition, then there would be treatment to follow.
Oh, I thought it was a little more liberal than that, right? Doesn't it allow for treatment for conditions that are potentially, even just potentially related to?
Maybe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
Let me ask you, the board decision that we have in front of us decided a claim for disability compensation for leukopenia. How does the registry impact one way or another whether the appellant is entitled to leukopenia compensation benefits?
Your Honor, the registry is not directly connected to the leukopenia benefits.
Okay, so if they're unrelated, I know the court has discretion to consider an argument raised here first. If it's with respect to something that we have jurisdiction over, what we have jurisdiction over is leukopenia. If the registry is unrelated to the claim that's before us, how do we have jurisdiction? What's our jurisdictional hook to even consider the impact of the registry?
The registry is a part of the claim under 3309, which Mr. Score raised multiple times below. And Mr. Score also has a skin cancer claim that was implicitly denied by the BVA. It was explicitly mentioned in the BVA's opinion of detailing leukopenia.
Okay, so you've raised the issue of skin cancer. We can go down that road, but even assuming that he did raise skin cancer, we don't have a board decision on skin cancer, an express board decision on skin cancer. So if he raised an NOD, filed an NOD to that claim, was there ever an SOC on skin cancer?
Your Honor, there, as far as I'm aware, there is not an SOC on skin cancer, but under the implicit denial doctrine, it's not clear that that is necessary.
Even assuming that that doctrine applies up here, if he's filed an NOD at the RO and never received an SOC, wouldn't his remedy be to go to the RO and ask for an SOC on the skin cancer claim?
Because the BVA in this case explicitly mentioned his skin cancer claim and did not grant those benefits, it has implicitly denied the claim for skin cancer.
But if we find that skin cancer is not before the court, the registry is also not before the court?
The registry would still be before this court because Mr. Score raised multiple times the arbitrary and capricious exclusion of Palomares from 38309.
But to Judge Allen's point, what benefit does he get from being added there if he doesn't have one of the 21 listed conditions?
The benefit he gets is that all veterans who participated in the radiation risk activities as defined by the regulation 38309 are automatically entitled to the ionizing radiation registry.
But the appellant himself, does he have standing to challenge that issue if we're just talking about a leukopenia claim in front of us?
Mr. Score would certainly have standing because of the injury that he suffers from the exclusion of Palomares from 3309. That injury is his exclusion from the ionizing radiation registry program.
Well, going back to Judge Allen's point, are you finished?
No, go ahead.
You attached to your brief, your reply brief, the VHA Directive 1301, which really is the Ionizing Radiation Registry Program. Let me direct your attention to paragraph 1 of that document. I'll give you a moment to get it. Actually touches on both Judge Meredith and Judge Allen's questions. As far as I can tell, Mr. Meyer, Mr. Score, if he were a listed on this registry, would receive free clinical evaluations, history, physical, and ancillary testing. Is there anything else that he would receive if he were listed on this registry?
One moment, Your Honor.
Sure.
As we are aware, Your Honor, those are the benefits that are conferred by participants in the ionizing radiation registry program.
Well, I'm going to ask VA when they stand up about Group 6 eligibility for VA health care for radiogenic veterans. So maybe we can get into that at that point, but that may be an issue that confers something on the veteran. But I'd like to talk a little bit about bringing in groups of veterans who aren't before the court right now. Veterans who, for example, have final board decisions that they did not appeal to this court. Again, you talked about us using the All Writs Act in aid of our prospective jurisdiction. They already had an opportunity to appeal to this court, but did not, as opposed to the folks who are still at the agency. How is that in aid of our prospective jurisdiction?
Because this court can waive the finality and exhaustion requirements. Those are, because they're non-jurisdictional, those are waivable requirements to take jurisdiction over those issues. However, we are not asking this court to take jurisdiction over the underlying claims for benefits, but rather over the legal issues at hand.
So you're asking us to equitably toll those claims? As opposed to waiving finality because they already have finality.
In a way, yes, but because we're not asking this court to take jurisdiction over the underlying benefits claims, then...
So, okay, let's say we don't take jurisdiction over their entire claim, just this issue. I'm just trying to figure out how it would work if we end up finding in favor of your client and the class. They don't have a pending claim anymore. They have this theory that would now apply to them. How does that assist the veteran? They would still need new and material evidence to reopen a claim. They would have a new effective date for their claim because an interpretation of a new decision is not new and material evidence. I mean, an interpretation of a regulation is not a new material evidence. So what benefit comes to those veterans from us not taking jurisdiction over their entire claim?
the benefit comes in the relief ordering that their claims be re-adjudicated.
What authority do we have to circumvent VA's effective date and case law that says there's only two ways to vitiate finality through Q or new material evidence, other than a settlement in like the NEMR context where VA agreed to do more than what the law required? What authority do we have to order that kind of relief?
This court does have authority over the Secretary to the extent that some benefits have been unlawfully withheld. And the second of two veterans class actions that predate this court, the first being NEMR that you've mentioned, which ended in a settlement. The second involved the National Association of Radiation Survivors. And in that court, the district court did order that claims should be re-adjudicated. And that serves as...
What authority did they use for that?
At this moment, I'm not sure, Your Honor, but it's important to note that remedy can be addressed and briefed at a later stage.
Could I turn you to 3.311 for a second? And this question goes to likely adequacy of representation. Is there any issue in your mind that Mr. Score is one of the, what is it? Is it the high 24, if I got that right?
High 26, Your Honor.
High 26. All right. I was close. So here's my concern. So he's at the top of the exposure list, and the argument is that the dose methodology is arbitrary, right? So it's got to be better. What if one were to say Mr. Score is not adequate to represent the interests of the class because all he's got to do is move the needle just a little bit to just capture more of the people at the top? Are you seeing what I'm saying? So this is equivalent to the issue the Supreme Court dealt with in a case like Amchem, where, I mean, it's analogous, where, you know, if I'm sick today in a dollar case, I don't care if the fund exists 20 years from now. I want solvency now. Whereas if I'm not yet sick and I have a long latency period, I don't care about payouts now. I need the fund to be alive down the road. This is sort of like that. So I want to give you a chance to address that because that is something that's concerning to me.
Yeah, there are at least a couple ways why that is not exactly analogous. The first is that the arbitrary and capricious actions complained of impact the doses provided for all of the subsetted groups included in the Labatt-Anderson report. And more importantly, the way those groups are segmented is such that the lower end dose of the high 26 group is then the top end dose for the following group. So if you slide group one up, group two would follow as well.
And are you asking, and this goes to something Judge Meredith touched on, are you asking on the 311 claim, number one, as I understand it, you're not asking us to strike the regulation, right?
That's correct.
Okay, and second, you're asking us to determine that the current dose methodology is arbitrary and capricious, right?
Correct, yes.
Are you asking us to do the next step and say, and this is what the dose methodology is?
No, Your Honor, we're not asking. Of course you
are. Last one follow-up question on the registry.
Before you do, could you add 5 minutes, please?
Go ahead. Yeah.
Thank you. How does the registry relate to the class that you are trying to certify, which is for veterans who were denied service-connected disability compensation based on radiation? You're not seeking a class based on people who were denied access to the registry, so how does it relate to your proposed class?
Because all members of the class and all Palomares veterans are denied access to the ionizing radiation registry, because Palomares is excluded from 3309.
But how does that relate to whether or not they receive disability compensation?
In terms of disability compensation is not directly connected to participation in the ionizing radiation registry program. But those health screenings are certainly a benefit that could lead to disability compensation if radiogenic diseases are turned up in those screenings.
Mr. Meyer, to the best of your knowledge, why isn't Palomares on the radiation risk activity list in Directive 1301?
To the best of my knowledge, there's no clear reason why the Secretary has not recognized Palomares under 3309.
Well, it's because the Secretary acted arbitrarily, capriciously, and unreasonably in not including it.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Commissioner.
Okay.
I'm sorry, are you done?
No, I am. Go ahead.
Okay, now turning to the folks who have yet to have final board decisions. Some Social Security cases have found the requirement for a final agency decision to be waivable. What is your basis for asserting that that would be waivable here?
One basis that the operative statutory framework in the Social Security benefits context is slightly different because the way those appeals are channeled into the district court. And secondly, those cases often involve taking jurisdiction under the underlying benefits claim. To the extent that finality is waivable here, this is really a request for this court in the interests of the veterans in this class who are in their 70s and 80s to waive the finality requirement and the relief offered.
So it's sort of an equitable kind of a request, as opposed to a basis in law?
An equitable request.
Related to Judge Schulman's question, are you familiar with a case, Pittston Coal Group?
I am slightly familiar.
It's the black lung case with the very weird lineup at the Supreme Court that decided it. But that case refused to certify a class of minors with black lung disease who had not gone through the administrative process. So in other words, it was a non-Social Security case, which was sort of hard to find. Do you have any position on why our situation is different than that? And just giving you an opportunity.
Yeah, there's certainly many reasons why our situation is different. First and foremost, this class would be composed of veterans, which Congress has long sought to instill that the Secretary and the governing administration provide the benefit of doubt to veterans and ensure that when they provide benefits to veterans, there is a fair and consistent process to the distribution of those benefits. And that really underlies the essence of why this should be a class action. We are seeking consistent and fair, lawful implementation of the benefits that Congress wants these veterans to have. And the simple thing is, for far too long, that Palomares veterans have been denied benefits they are entitled to under the law. And this court is in the best position to ensure that those veterans have the benefits they are entitled to.
One more question. Your response to Judge Scholin's question, I just want to make sure I understand, about the waiving the board decision, that there be a board decision. I'm getting confused about the relationship between how you explained to me and to Judge Allen earlier this, the All Writs Act would kick in here, and your description of waivability to Judge Scholin. Can you just...
I see your time is about to expire, Mr. Myers. Could you add 5 more minutes? But you may answer the question.
But the All Writs Act is not jurisdictional. It provides the authority under which this court can act in aid of its prospective jurisdiction. the questions of waiving finality are more concerned with this court acting in an equitable manner to ensure that those in the class whose claims have been denied in the past are able to access and provided the relief this court grants at the end of this case in the event it rules for appellant.
Mr. Meyer, a moment ago you indicated that Congress wanted the Palomares veterans to be to receive benefits. Couldn't Congress amend the underlying statute to add Palomares as a radiation risk activity?
Your Honor, Congress could amend the underlying statute, but the issue here is the Secretary's unlawful interpretation of that statute. That statute, the regulation at issue here, states that where service in a capacity as a civilian would lead to benefits, and that is under a scheme for the Department of Energy and civilians working there, where they would receive benefits for exposure to ionizing radiations, veterans should also be receiving benefits. In this case, veterans without protective equipment bury irradiated soil into barrels, and they do not have access to benefits. The sealed barrels were then buried in South Carolina. Sealed barrels, those civilians do have benefits. Here, the Secretary is acting in an arbitrary and capricious manner, and this court has the power, without Congress, to rule that these veterans are entitled to benefits.
But Congress could specifically include them like they did in other instances.
Congress could specifically include them, and the VA Secretary has, in the past, added incidences to the regulation without the action of Congress.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Meyer. Mr. Vichich, we will add 10 minutes to your time if you need it.
Thank you, Chief Judge Davis. The Secretary would like to focus his argument today on four general areas. The first is the jurisdictional questions raised in this case. Second involves the doctrine of administrative exhaustion. Third involves the doctrine of finality. And fourth, the Secretary will address Rule 23 factors and the due process concerns. So I'll start with the jurisdictional question. This court's jurisdiction is limited to reviewing decisions of the Board of Veterans' Appeals, and the authority to entertain class actions is not an excuse to waive that jurisdictional requirement. The Supreme Court has addressed this issue in the Social Security context in a number of cases, the first of which was Weinberger versus Salfie. That case stands for a simple proposition, and that is that when a statute imposes a jurisdictional requirement for obtaining judicial review, each member of the putative class must satisfy that requirement. It doesn't matter that the appellant is not asking this court to resolve underlying benefits claims. He is asking for at least partial relief on the merits. And I think one of Judge Allen's questions raised a point that is worth making. He asked about the All Writs Act and used the term plug-in to say, well, are you asking the court to take jurisdiction over this board decision, resolve an issue, and then plug it into those cases pending below, or perhaps cases that have claims that have not yet been filed? And that is why 7252 prevents the court from giving the relief that appellant is seeking, because he is asking this court to resolve one or two legal questions on the merits for claims pending below. And the All Writs Act has not been used by this court in that manner. The All Writs Act has been used to grant procedural-based relief as opposed to merits-based relief.
Mr. Vichich,
yes.
Are you suggesting that the Federal Circuit's Monk decision is inconsistent with Salfie with respect to the scope of the court's jurisdiction?
No. Monk, the Federal Circuit's discussion of 7252 in Monk has to be read in context of the relief requested in that case. And there, the petitioner was seeking procedural relief, getting the this court to order the secretary to process benefits, his benefits claims and those of his class members. He was not asking this court to resolve any questions on the merits of those claims. And it's quite simply, the Federal Circuit just did not address the issue here.
But it did on page 1320, if I recall, where it discussed why they do not read our jurisdictional provision as restrictively as we did before the Federal Circuit indicated that we did have certification authority.
Right? Chief Judge Davis, the question answered in Monk is best thought of, does 7252 provide an absolute prohibition to aggregating claims? That is, does 7252 prevent this court from ever having a class action? And the answer to that question is no. There are instances in which this court can certify a class. What Monk did not address is whether there are any instances in which 7252 might limit this court's ability to do so. And that's the question raised here, is can the court do this in appeals context and provide relief on the merits to persons whose claims have not been the subject of a board decision?
Let me ask you a question about this on the merits distinction that you're making. In City of New York Bowen versus City of New York, the issue was this secret policy to terminate benefits for people, and so the class was people who had mental disabilities that were being affected by this policy. So while the question at the Supreme Court was who got to be part of the class, the underlying relief that they were seeking was reinstatement of their benefits and termination of this applicability of this policy. So aren't there sort of merits there?
Yeah, absolutely. But in that case, every class member satisfied the jurisdictional requirements in 405G.
Well, no, there were folks there who were still down at the agency who hadn't had a final decision yet, I believe. And the court said that we're going to waive it because there was this nefarious secret policy, and these people, it would be futile for them to have appealed.
And they waived that issue because it was non-jurisdictional. If the requirement were jurisdictional, it could not be waived, and that's the distinction. And 7252, as even the Supreme Court in Henderson recognized, 7252 is jurisdictional. It cannot be waived. And that's the distinction, that there's the line of cases, beginning with the Weinberger versus Salfi, Califano versus Yamasaki, and then Bowen versus City of New York. And the class composition hinged on whether this was a jurisdictional, non-waivable requirement or whether it was something that was required but could be waived if necessary. And a board decision in this court is a jurisdictional, non-waivable requirement.
So, but, you know, the follow-up with Chief Judge Davis's point, I understand the argument that you're making about the Federal Circuit's decision in Monk and 7252A. I mean, I understand that you've conveyed that. And I agree with you that it's a little bit inscrutable about what the Federal Circuit is saying here. But doesn't it strike you as a little bit odd that your argument would be it was okay that 7252A didn't provide an issue in Monk, even though there was no final board decision anywhere, but here we unquestionably have a final board decision? I mean, we have jurisdiction over Mr. Skor's claim. But now somehow that provides an obstacle. Do you see what I'm saying? It's sort of odd to read the Federal Circuit's language as doing what you suggest.
Judge Allen, the difference is the writ petition. In the writ petition context, there will never be a board decision. Yet this court's ability to exercise jurisdiction over writ petitions is not disputed. This court has been exercising that jurisdiction for years, notwithstanding the lack of a board decision. So I wouldn't just because there is a board decision here, and there's no question that this court has jurisdiction over Mr. Skor's board decision. What Mr. Skor is asking this court to do is take jurisdiction over the merits of benefits claims pending below or that may not have even been filed that have not been the subject of a board decision.
Well, but why is it this point you keep making about the merits? I mean, it is related to the merits, but it isn't deciding or it isn't necessarily going to lead to the award of a benefit in everybody's case, right?
Correct. But it will still resolve at least one question in that case.
So why doesn't, though, that make all the difference? In other words, we are not substituting for an appeal here if we were to use something like the All Writs Act once our jurisdictional light switch has been turned on because of Mr. Skor, right? We are just answering a question, frankly, in the same way in which we would if we ruled with a precedential opinion. It would plug in the same way, wouldn't it?
No, it would not, for at least two reasons. First, this court would be giving an enforceable judgment on to those individual class members, which means if that is not in their favor, they would be precluded from in the future raising challenges on that same legal issue, whereas a precedential decision, the putative class members, who would not be class members in that instance, would be able to distinguish their case on the facts. They could raise new legal arguments to the same challenge. And this is this court in the McDowell case addressed this issue where a class member from a district court case was part of a class that challenged a statute on constitutional grounds, and then that veteran came to this court and wanted to challenge the same statute but on a different constitutional ground, and this court said, well, you were a member of that class, therefore you could have raised this in that prior proceeding. We are not going to hear your case now. That's a distinction. That preclusive effect is the primary distinction between just a regular panel decision and certifying a class. The class members may not want this legal issue resolved in the way Mr. Skor is trying to resolve them, particularly with the 3.311 issue, where class members may be satisfied with the dose estimate provided, or they may want to pursue a different remedy. But Mr. Skor would ask this court to actually go into those claims and determine for those persons how that issue is going to be resolved without giving them the opportunity to pursue that claim as they want to pursue it.
Well, wait a minute. Can't they opt out if we were to certify a class and fashion a remedy after appropriate notice? I mean, federal courts have been dealing with this since forever. This is an equity principle long before there was Rule 23. What's wrong with giving veterans who want to opt out of the class, assuming we certify a class, that opportunity in our order, supervised by persons we appoint to supervise the class?
Judge Greenberg, the Secretary agrees that an opt-out, notice and opt-out provision would satisfy a lot of these due process concerns.
Thank you.
That's correct.
But why are there due process concerns? I mean, the Supreme Court has made, it seems to me, really, really clear that in a 23B2 type class, that opt-out is not constitutionally required as it is under 23B3. I mean, so what is the constitutional concern?
Well, the concerns are the inability to raise a particular legal challenge or to distinguish a case on the merits. And again, I point to the McDowell case where this court actually did that. This court told a veteran, we're not going to hear your argument because you could have raised it as a class member. You had your opportunity.
Well, but that's why the requirements of commonality, typicality, adequacy of representation, and adequacy of counsel are there, right? Because we're binding a non-party, right?
Yes.
So, anyways, could you address the point that I raised with appellant's counsel as well about the fact, what, if any, effect does does the fact that this argument, these arguments about 3.309 and 3.311 were raised directly to the board and the RO, and the board never addressed them?
Yes. Secretary would have has 2 points. First, if for purely legal questions, this court can always hear those in the first instance, regardless of whether the board did. And that's the Majid or Maggot case from the Federal Circuit.
I have no idea what it is either.
Exactly. So. So there, if it's a purely legal matter, this court can resolve it. It having it go back to the board to hear to resolve a legal question in the first instance would serve no useful purpose.
So let me stop you there. Is the question, say, under 3.311, I mean, is that really a purely legal question here? I'm trying to work through that, right? Because, yeah, you could look at it and say it's arbitrary and capricious, but it seems to me the dose methodology point, as Judge Meredith has pointed out, has a lot of factual stuff to it.
It has factual implications, but the problem here is that the record before the board, does not contain the evidence that the appellant is relying on to make his argument.
So, on that point, and this is why I floated the idea to appellant's counsel about a remand with us retaining jurisdiction, because Mr. Score made the argument to the board that this is an arbitrary and capricious dose estimate in violation of the law. It seems to me the board could have done something to develop that, which would then have gotten this information into the record.
If that's the position, then we're left with just a regular reasons or bases error. But to make his argument, he attaches a scientific report that was created after the board's decision. And this court cannot look at that evidence to resolve the question on the merits. So.
Can I follow up on that? So following along with what Judge Allen was saying, if this argument was explicitly raised to VA, it wasn't addressed, and a remand was the appropriate remedy, what impact does that have on whether or not we should certify a class in your view? If we can't address on the merits the relief that the named appellant is seeking, what impact does that have on whether we should certify the class?
Well, under 23b2, this court cannot certify the class because the relief under 23b2 must be that can be given to the entire class. So the class motion fails on that basis if a remand is required.
Well, couldn't we do what the court used to do a lot in its early history, which is retain jurisdiction? In other words, send it back to the board, have the board do what it should have done, and then come right back to us with the class motion pending. What about that option?
I don't have a response, Judge Allen. I can't. Yes, that is something this court can do. Yes.
So would you want this court to do that?
No.
Okay. If you're not going to win outright, and we're going to talk about this issue, is that though at least a secondary thing that the secretary would be okay with?
That would be a reasonable. The secretary would be okay with that option. Before I move on from the jurisdiction.
Oh, wait a minute. You say the secretary would be okay with that? These veterans are 70 or 80 years old. How long is it going to take for the secretary to be okay with that and come back to us with a decision if you accept this proposition? You're an experienced lawyer in the general counsel's office of the VA. How long is it going to take? 2 years? Longer?
If this court feels that additional development is necessary, then
then what?
Then the secretary would accept that and develop more evidence if this record is not sufficient. for this court to conduct the...
Could you estimate how long that's going to take?
No, Your Honor.
Based upon your past experience?
I cannot answer that.
What, Mr. Vitrich, what if the court imposed a deadline or a time frame? Could the court impose a deadline or a time frame on how long that development should take?
No.
Really?
So it's the Secretary's position that the court lacks authority to tell the board that it needs to do something in a set period of time?
Yes, that's your position, isn't it?
You may take a moment and consult with co-counsel.
Yes, this court could impose a particular deadline.
And the Secretary would comply?
The Secretary would comply.
Or be held in contempt under the statute.
This court does have contempt authority.
Yes.
And we could impose sanctions personally on the Secretary for failure to comply.
That's correct. Before I move on from the jurisdictional argument, I wanted to address a point that Judge Greenberg raised about the constitutional dimension. That issue was one addressed in Weinberger v. Salfi, one of the Supreme Court cases that we addressed, that we raised. In that case, the Supreme Court held that the constitutional questions were derivative of the statute, and because the statute had a jurisdictional requirement, that jurisdictional requirement had to be met for the class members. So we would argue that even if there are constitutional questions raised, 7252 does limit this court's ability to compose a class based on pending claims pending below. I'd like to shift to the administrative exhaustion requirement. This is jurisdiction is not waivable. Exhaustion can be waivable, assuming that this court does hold that it can compose a class for veterans for claims that are still pending below. The Secretary would ask the court to not do so for two reasons. First, Congress has created a system that requires veterans to go through the appeals process before getting to this court. And composing a class and ordering some sort of relief on the merits would prematurely interrupt that administrative process. Second, requiring those veterans to appeal to the board would not be futile because ultimately what they're seeking for benefit, what they are seeking is benefits, and they can still be awarded benefits regardless of the answers to the legal questions raised in this case. On the finality question, I wanted to address Judge Scholin has some questions about this issue. The Pittston case, we would argue, does control here. There are limited circumstances where courts have waived finality requirements for composing a class. The Bowen v. City of New York case is one, but in that case, the class, the adjudicated claims were limited to about a three-year period. And the veterans there were challenging a secret unpublished policy. And the Pittston case issued several years later indicated that that holding, the City of New York holding, was narrow and the Supreme Court held that the agency should not be ordered to reopen claims that are finally adjudicated when those class members could have challenged that the regulation at the time. As far as whether there is any authority for this court to order the Secretary to reopen and re-adjudicate claims, the Secretary is not aware of any such authority.
Let me ask you a little bit what I was asking him, which was if reaching the claims that have final board decisions but did not appeal to the court, why couldn't the court equitably toll the 120-day notice of appeal period to bring the entire claim in and toll it such that it would still be pending, and then any favorable decision that we made would be applicable to those appellants as well?
So, whether the court could do that? Yes. Whether it should? No.
because for the main reason is that his class membership does not have a temporal limit. He's not saying anybody who was denied benefits by the board within the past year or 2 years or so on. He gives no limit. Is he asking the court to equitably toll a person whose benefits were denied by the board 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20? He does not attach that limit to his motion.
Why do you think a temporal limit is a good thing? Why is that necessary? Why is that relevant?
Well, it's the basic, the doctrine of finality. It's just as there should be a starting point for a benefits claim, there should be an ending point. And whether, if the court is going to waive that, there should be a limit. Some of it goes to the merits. He's asking this court to he's challenging procedures that were put into place sometime in the year 2001 for the 3.311 issue. But if the board denied benefits in the 1990s, that decision would have had nothing to do with that particular procedure. So there would be no reason to equitably toll those.
But 3309, adding a radiation risk activity, that would potentially apply to everybody. I mean, adding Palomares as a radiation risk activity.
Well, the appellant himself does not have a valid claim under that regulation because he has not been denied benefits for any of those conditions.
Well, he doesn't have a final board decision before the court, you would assert. But I think he has been denied skin cancer down below.
Correct. And
which
cancer,
is a radiogenic, but not a radiation. Yeah, no.
Skin cancer is not on the 3.309. Yes, yes.
What about the IRR point? I'd like to get your view about that.
I think I would like to address one of Judge Meredith's questions where she asked, what is the jurisdictional hook? And the answer is, there is none. There's no, that, the ionizing radiation registry is not at all tied to the denial of service connection for leukopenia. So that's one point the Secretary wants to make.
What about an argument that because this was expressly raised below to the board, meaning that the exclusion of Palomares from 3.309, and then the board never explored that, right? Never explored the issue at all. What about the argument that because the board didn't explore that issue, then there was never an opportunity to develop something that related to whether or not the IRR benefit standing on its own was something that was sufficient for Mr. Score?
I have two responses. First, if exclusion from that list is a matter that the board could adjudicate, it would be jurisdictionally distinct from a benefits claim. The IRR is monitored by the Veterans Health Administration. That's a, by statute, that is separate from the Veterans Benefits Administration. That would have to be adjudicated by the Veterans Health Administration and appealed to the board separately. And there's nothing in this record that shows that that happened. Second is that put on the list, there's no harm by not being on that list. There's no injury. It's future injury. If he came and said, well, I now have this cancer, and if I were on the list, I may have gotten earlier treatment, then maybe that would constitute an injury. But it's speculation at this point that his exclusion from that list would have has harmed him in any way.
So, but the real question is whether if he filed a claim with VHA disagreeing with their decision to not put him on the list, is that something that VHA would have to adjudicate? And if so, isn't that a benefit?
That's an answer that is not clear to me. It's a hypothetical at this point because I'm not aware that Mr. Scar has asked to be placed on that list, let alone that he attempted to appeal any such denial. So assuming that could be an issue that could a benefit, a health care benefit that could be appealed to the board, it's simply not one that has been appealed
in this case?
I mentioned I would be asking you this. On the VA website for veterans eligible for VA health care benefits, Group 6, it says veterans who are exposed to ionizing radiation as a result of testing, development, or employment of an atom bomb in World War II are also qualified for Group 6. Atomic veterans may have been exposed to ionizing radiation a variety of ways at various locations. For example, those exposed in a nuclear device testing site or during the occupation are included. So, is it your understanding that Group 6 of health care eligibility coverage incorporates veterans who have participated in a radiation risk activity?
I'm not prepared to answer that, Your Honor. I apologize. I'm not familiar with that.
Well, why not?
Yeah, I thought you mentioned health care Group 6 benefits in your brief.
No, no.
Well, then I think they mentioned it in their briefs because I got it from someone.
No, today I do not recall. It certainly was not in the Secretary's pleadings. Today was the first I heard of Group 6.
Let's just assume, for argument's sake, that if Palomares was included in the list of activities on 3.309, that veterans like Mr. Score would be eligible for health care under Category 6. Would that be a different argument, or would you be arguing the same thing that he would have needed to present for eligibility for health care and then challenge that denial of eligibility through VHA you're arguing to, like the IRR?
With respect to Mr. Score, he does have a number of service-connected disabilities, so he already has he already is eligible for health care. So I'm not sure that there would be any additional benefit to being placed into Group 6. And I think it goes back to Judge Meredith's questions, is what's the jurisdictional hook here where the board denied service connection for leukopenia?
Mr. Bridges, do you know why leukopenia is not on the 309 list?
No, Your Honor.
Do you know what may have contributed to that decision-making process at the department?
I'm not aware that condition has been even looked at as a possible condition to be put on the list. I'm not aware of that.
Oh, if it were to be put on the list, how would that occur? Through your rulemaking process?
Yes, it would be codified in 3.309. It would be published and within the usual course, just like the others that have been placed on the list, yes.
So 3.309 and 3.311 went through the rulemaking process?
Yes.
So there's been some lots of talk about jurisdiction with respect to 7252A. But let me just draw your attention to 7252B. And I'd like to ask you to kind of speak to that, where 7252B says that a court may not review the schedule of ratings for disabilities adopted under Section 1155 of this title or any action of the Secretary in adopting or revising the schedule. Can you talk to that? Does that give us or not give us jurisdiction over disagreements of 309 and 311?
No, the Secretary would not rely on that regulation or that portion of the statute here because we're not talking about disability ratings. Okay. The Secretary interprets that to be what's found in Part 4, and we're dealing here with Part 3 of Title 38 of the CFR, so the Secretary is not aware of any instance where that particular portion of the statute has been relied on for adjudicating service connection issues.
Well, I'd like to stick with jurisdiction if I can and go back to a series of questions that we were asking Mr. Score's counsel, and that is this notion of, for lack of a better word, like a hybrid matter here, that the board decision in Mr. Score's case is the jurisdictional hook. And once we've established that, which we have, we filed an NOA, the court could use the All Writs Act to kind of pull the rest of, think of it as like tentacles pulling all of these other cases into our jurisdiction? And are there any cases on that? I had mentioned to Appellant's Counsel Yamasaki.
The cases that we have located are from the Social Security context, the Weinberger v. Salfi, Califano v. Yamasaki, and Bowen v. City of New York. And we read those as holding that if there's a statute provides a jurisdictional requirement, every member of the class must meet that jurisdictional requirement. And 7252A, it requires a board decision. And that's the basis for the Secretary's argument that composing a class in an appeal context is beyond the authority of 7252. And that's why the Secretary is arguing that the court's exercise of its class action authority should be limited to the written petition context.
What about if we had a context like the Smith tinnitus cases years ago? Were you with the department at that time?
I was.
Okay. So we had 1,000 cases pending here at the court who had final board decisions, all had a discrete legal question. So they were all here. They weren't tentacles down at the agency. So in that context, would the Secretary advocate that we would not grant the class action?
If they were subject to final board decisions, there's the jurisdictional questions are not there, the jurisdictional problems. There could be some finality problems if we're talking about 10-year-old board decisions.
Well, they're in theory here on appeal, so they wouldn't
yes,
be.
Yes, and then in that, this court could use its existing procedures under Rule 3 to consolidate those and answer a particular legal question, and that's something that this court has been able to do for many years. And
yes, but the court had to issue 1,000 decisions potentially or some sort of order consolidating all of them in some way. So it may or may not be a cleaner, faster way to dispose of 1,000-plus class cases, class member cases. But so in that instance, the Secretary wouldn't necessarily oppose assuming all the other criteria.
Not on jurisdictional grounds. That's the the line. If there's a board decision, then there's the jurisdictional problem is simply not there.
Could I get back to the Federal Circuit's decision in Monk? It talked about our court's decision in Harrison, which gave three reasons for why we wouldn't do class actions, because we lacked authority, it was highly unmanageable in an appellate context, and it was unnecessary because we could issue precedential decisions. And then the Federal Circuit expressly overturned one prong, that we lacked the power. In our recent Monk decision, we suggested that it may be an open question as to whether manageability and necessity are relevant considerations still in determining whether we should certify a class. Can you give us the Secretary's position on whether those are relevant considerations?
Yes, they are relevant considerations, and they are related. And because of this court's inherent jurisdiction, because the Secretary is bound by all panel decisions, there's little to be gained from the class action procedure, especially when you consider the possible preclusive effect of the class members, the inability of class members to distinguish their cases on the facts, the burdens on the court and the parties for managing the class. Those are still relevant considerations, yes, and that's why the Secretary is asking the court to use this tool sparingly, if at all, even if it can, in the appeals context, do that.
Counsel, just quickly, I want to put a bow on something we've sort of discussed a couple times. But when Mr. Score, wrote the letters requesting that the board look into the methodology and then the scientific methodology, et cetera, is it the agency's position that a board member need not address that issue, need not adjudicate that issue, that it's beyond the jurisdiction of the board to address that? I mean, what's the exact position in terms of that, irrespective of a class? I mean, just a solo petitioner saying, when you adjudicate my claim, I think it's based on dubious science, so, you know, address this as well. What's the position on that?
Okay, I want to try to answer your question. The board is required to provide a statement of reasons or bases for questions of material questions of material fact or law presented on the record, which could be brought. So if a veteran raises a particular argument, theory, the board is required to address it. So now the board is bound by regulation, so the board is, does not have authority to overturn one of the secretary's own regulations.
Right.
But it certainly, the board would be required to respond to points raised.
Okay. But I mean, in 7252B, it says, you know, the review in our court shall be on the record of proceedings before the secretary and the board, right? So these are two different, and the idea would be, you know, you bring your board, you challenge something before the board, and you say, yes, I'd like to also challenge the secretary's methodology in making this determination as it applies to my case, right? And if I'm understanding correctly, the position is that that's simply something that the board need not make a decision on or address in any sort of summary, in any full fashion.
No, the secretary, the board is required to respond to arguments raised. That's part of the reason for basis statute.
Right, but if the argument is, you know, the inclusion or the dosimetry, I mean, this is obviously a bigger ticket item. Are they required to dig in and say, okay, well, we've looked at the methodology, or the secretary's rationale in terms of their public comments about this are such, at least give an official description, or they just have to mention, oh, yes, and the veteran raised this argument, nothing to see here, moving on? I mean, I guess that's my question is, at what level does the board have to adjudicate these questions? Or are they simply going to kind of take a flyer and it's a bigger ticket item, go look at the Federal Circuit and kind of proceed there?
The best practice for an instance like an argument like this would be for the board to acknowledge it, respond to it, and say we're bound by the regulations. If it's a pure question of law, if a case gets to this court, then even if the board ignored it, or if the board addressed it, or if it even wasn't raised below, as long as the court has the jurisdictional hook under the underlying claim, this court does have the authority to hear the new legal arguments or legal arguments that were just not addressed for one reason or another.
Did the board err here by not addressing the three-point, let's just stick with what is the simplest question, the 3.311 argument?
The secretary is reluctant to address the merits of the case.
I don't want you to address the merits. I want you to answer the question that I just raised, right, which is not optional, did the board err by not addressing the question of that Mr. Score directly raised, which is the methodology under 3.311 is arbitrary and capricious? I actually think he used that language. Was it an error for the board not to address that at all?
The secretary won't concede that there was any error here. Whether the statement of reasons or bases was adequate depends on whether the board provided a sufficient explanation for this court to review the factual findings.
It didn't say anything about it.
If it's a legal question, then...
But this isn't a legal question, right? That's why I'm focusing on 311. Because Mr. Score, there's no conception under which one can say that his argument was to strike down the regulation. It was, the regulation says you have to use sound science, and the methodology used here is not sound. Wouldn't the board have an obligation to do something with respect to that?
The secretary agrees that the board has to respond to its particular points, and I would have to go back to the board decision to identify any particular portions of that decision where the board may have responded to that. And the court's order for supplemental briefing in this case stated that the secretary does not want to evade your question, but he's not prepared to make any merits concessions as to whether the board erred.
So let's just assume that we think that might be a defect because we're deciding whether to certify a question for a class that the board was presented with but didn't do something. Let's just assume that's the case. In that scenario, then, wouldn't it make sense to let the board answer that question first and then have it come right back to us with a time delay? This is why I was asking that question earlier.
Well, because the board is bound by regulations, so the board would have to follow the regulations anyway. And the procedures in 3.311 were required by statute. So if the board followed those, the statute requires the secretary to develop these 3.311 procedures, and the board is required to make sure that those were followed.
Well, so, yeah, but I mean to take a ludicrous example, right? If 3.311 says you have to use sound science to develop this, okay, and the secretary then develops a quote policy that the way we're going to decide any individual veteran at Palomares whether they were exposed sufficiently is to flip a coin, and heads say yes and tails say no. The board wouldn't be striking down the regulation in that context to say that's not based on sound science, right?
Correct. The board, if there's a question like that, the board would have the authority to remand a case so that sound science could, so that the regional office could follow the regulation. So if there's a case where it's very clear that the regional office did not follow the requirements of 3.311, the board does have authority to remand it and require the agency to do so. I'd like to shift to the Rule 23 factors briefly. Commonality, typicality, adequacy, and numerosity, excuse me. Just to highlight some points we made in our brief, the appellant has the burden, or the movement has the burden of demonstrating satisfaction with these requirements. He has not done so. For numerosity, he does not identify or give an idea as to how many members might be in this class. As for commonality, his legal questions, because the scope that he proposes a class is broad in scope, so broad that the questions he raised would not answer questions for all the class members. And his case is sort of highlights that. He's asking the court to rule on this 3.309 issue as far as the definition of radiation risk activity, but his benefits claim, leukopenia, it has nothing to do with that regulation. In fact, the board even said that regulation is not for consideration. So even if the court were to resolve that issue, he would not gain anything from that, which, and these factors bleed into one another. So because he does not satisfy commonality, he does not satisfy typicality, his legal claims are not necessarily typical of those of his class members, because they may have been injured for different reasons than what he claims to have been injured by. And that also leads to the adequacy issue, is that there may be other veterans who are better suited to bring these challenges than he, because he has not been injured by the very, at least especially for 3.309, the regulation he seeks to challenge.
Well, what about 3.311? Can you just go through especially the commonality, typicality, and adequacy of representation for 3.311?
For 3.311, his argument on the merits is focused particularly on that report created in April 2001, which the Air Force has used to calculate dose estimates for approximately 19 veterans. The problem in this class is that he's not limiting it to veterans who have been denied benefits based on that report. So answering, if this court were to say that that was an arbitrary and capricious method used.
But he points out that we can modify the class as we see fit.
That's correct. But then he runs into a numerosity problem, because there's simply just not a very large number of veterans who would fall into that category of persons.
Well, I thought he just said during his presentation that the secretary would be the one who could provide the information about numerosity, and that he's not well equipped to do that.
Well, there's It's not as easy as just pulling these up out of a database because they're not tracked in that manner. The secretary could say determine who had been denied benefits for radiation exposure, but to go to this granular level and determine who had been denied benefits based on particular method is not something that would be administratively feasible.
Isn't that beside the point? We know how many service members were at Palomares. We know how many, somebody knows, the Department of Defense knows. Easy for the secretary to get that information from defense, isn't it? Who was doing all this work in the 1966 time frame? Who cleaned it up? Who buried it in South Carolina? Where are they now? All to be determined. What's wrong with that as a class? Everybody who did all of these things is the class.
What the secretary would go back to the point he made a minute ago is that it's the movement's burden to satisfy these requirements. The movement would have the burden of getting this information from the Department of Defense in a class
conference. That's the secretary's position? The burden is on the veteran to identify who is in the class of person that I just described. They were at Palomares, they cleaned up the mess, the radiation, buried it in South Carolina, and came home. That's the class. What's wrong with that?
Well, the secretary, again, if we're talking about just who was present at the site, that's a different issue than who's in the class, because he's asking for the class to be composed of those who were denied or will be denied benefits. And then that, applying the commonality question, inquiry, the typicality inquiry, that's where his class runs into problems.
Let me ask you a question. Has the secretary granted any benefits to anybody who was at Palomares who cleaned it up, either under the statute or under its regulation?
I don't know, Your Honor. I do not.
Thank you.
Just to be clear, the secretary can't, I could go into, a database of board decisions and put in Palomares and come up with a number of veterans who were claiming that they were exposed there, who have board decisions. For regional office decisions, isn't there some way to check all rating decisions for a given year and put in the search term Palomares? And
there's no way to do that like one would do with Lexis or Westlaw, no.
The
regional office codes them, but not on this level of specificity.
They code them for the disability?
Yes.
And some exposure?
Yes.
If he were on the list, he would be, if Palomares was on the list, it would be coded. Correct.
I don't know.
Okay.
Where did the appellant's counsel get the term, the number 1600?
The record before the agency identifies as 1586, we'll say approximately 1600, who were sent to this crash site within that 2 to 3 month period, where they were two or 3 weeks at a time. But there were approximately 1600 service members who responded to that incident.
Why shouldn't we certify that as the class of person that we're going to deal with one way or another here?
Well, there are a number of reasons. Again, assuming the jurisdictional concerns are not present, it's looking at the common what common legal question would resolve their legal claims, and to know what common question might satisfy their legal claims requires knowing what legal claims they may have. And this is a difficult burden when many of them have not filed benefits claims, many of them may not be seeking benefits or may not have sought benefits.
Isn't that really the purpose of a class action? To explore whether this, whatever it's called, the Labatt-Anderson was junk science under a Daubert type of analysis, whether or not something that was unknown, unknowable in 1966 or 1967 has since got scientific credibility, whether people who were at Palomares had nothing to do with this particular cleanup operation? Isn't that all what a class action is supposed to separate? We have a discrete set of human beings, a favored class of person, a veteran, favored by Congress. Shouldn't the secretary do more than say it's up to the individual veteran to go find out how many people were involved to satisfy these Rule 23 notions? That's begging the question, by the way, as whether we should even apply Rule 23.
In a trial court, that would be a more of a an appropriate course of action. But in this appellate court, where the record is limited, this court just doesn't have the authority to commission studies and to generate medical scientific evidence. This court is, by statute, operating under different rules than trial courts. And that's presents some difficulties with certifying a case like this, where there is scientific evidence from after the board's decision that is being used to push the case forward on the merits.
Justice Alito says we are acting as an Article III, like an Article III court, in reviewing actions of federal administrative agencies under the Administrative Procedure Act. Why can't we consider the secretary functionally the equivalent of a federal district court, and ourselves acting as a reviewing authority as if we were an Article III court, as Alito said in Henderson?
The scope of review, yes, is similar to an Article III court, but again, the jurisdictional limitations just do not permit this court to have the sort of discovery tools available.
What limitations? Let's look back at Henderson. Congress said you shall file your appeal within 120 days, right?
That's correct.
And the Supreme Court said shall doesn't mean shall. It's an important procedural rule, but it's not jurisdictional. You're here arguing jurisdiction. Why can't we apply the same kind of standard here as the Supreme Court applied in Henderson?
Because 7252B is jurisdictional, and that limits this court's authority to review the board decision based on the evidence that was before the board.
So your argument would be that the only way around that would be to find either that that statute doesn't say what you say, mean what you say it means, or to find it unconstitutional. So those are only two choices from the secretary's standpoint. 7252, is that a statute you're referring to?
Yes. It's jurisdictional. Right. That's the secretary's position.
I understand.
Assuming, let's get back to you were going through the Rule 23 criteria for certification under 3.311, and we got stuck on numerosity. I have one more question as to that. Assuming that we find that Mr. Score has carried his burden as to alleging sufficient numbers of decisions on this, are you saying that you couldn't come up with, what would you do if we ordered you to come up with, well, how many veterans actually fall into this class? Let's say we're talking about only veterans who have filed claims based on Palomares exposure, filed and or already adjudicated. Could you do that? Are you saying you couldn't do it?
The secretary would attempt to comply with the court's order. The secretary can't speculate as to how burdensome that would be, but the secretary would make every attempt, of course, to follow the court's order.
Okay. Well, can you continue on with your analysis of 3.311, his 3.311 argument as to commonality, typicality, adequacy?
Yeah, on the commonality issue, we just want to highlight the point that he's challenging the specific procedure that was employed, that was implemented beginning in 2001 and beyond. But the problem is that if somebody's benefits claim was denied before that 2001, then there's no common legal question with what he raises and what those veterans might raise. So that's the point the Secretary is making.
Right. So if we modified the class to exclude the pre-2001.
That's correct, Judge Bartley. And we even conceded in our response in our supplemental brief is that defining the class narrowly here would easily satisfy these requirements. That's absolutely true.
And so you're saying that at least as to 3.311, he would satisfy the class requirements under a Rule 23-like analysis.
If the class were defined as those whose benefits were denied based on a dose estimate derived from that report, is that the two legal questions, constitutionality, arbitrary and capricious, that is a classic common question. Absolutely.
Would it be even narrower to those who were subject to a methodology after 2013, as Mr. Score was?
Yes. And the Air Force changed its methodology then, but if I recall correctly, that they were still using dose estimates derived from that report. They were just plugging them into a system a little bit different, so it would still satisfy commonality, yes.
Mr. Vincent, yes. You have 10 minutes if you'd like to use it. You have 1 minute left.
The Secretary has made the points he wants to make today, just to highlight what he's already argued in his pleadings. If there are further questions, the Secretary would be happy to address them, but there's nothing else that the Secretary feels that he needs to discuss today. Yes, Judge Beach.
More out of curiosity than anything else, I had read somewhere that Congress is entertaining some legislation regarding the Palmaris and the cleanup and the veterans. Do you know anything about that?
Very little. I know that in August, just last month, several congresspersons, I know one was Senator Blumenthal from Connecticut, proposed a bill that would address, as Judge Valley raised, that Congress could do what the appellant is asking it to do. I just know it's been introduced. I don't know very much more about it.
Now, if in that introduction process, the Congress came to the VA and asked them for information regarding numbers, et cetera, I guess you would have to respond one way or another to get that information.
Yes, and VA has, we respond to congressional inquiries all the time, yes.
Mm-hmm. Including numbers of how many were out there, how many were participants, how many filed claims.
Some of that responsibility may, information may be best obtained from Department of Defense. If it has to do with whether a claim has actually been filed for benefits, then VA would be in the best position to provide that information. But if the person has never filed a claim for benefits, then the Secretary would not have information on that. That would be Department of Defense would provide that. But that sort of fact-finding authority is something that the congressional committees use all the time. Yes. Thank you. The Secretary asks the court to deny the motion for class certification.
Thank you.
Your Honors, we are here today to discuss whether appellant's legal challenges should move forward on a class basis. And simply put, they should. Appellant raises here questions that lie at the threshold of individual class members' benefits claims, whether they have already been denied or whether they will be denied in the future. The Secretary raises the question of due process, asking whether it is in fact in the best interest of members of this class for this class to proceed as such. When the courts were determining and putting Rule 23b2 in place back in 1966, they noted that, in fact, in cases of injunction, due process is, in fact, vindicated by the class action mechanism. And here that's the case as well. These veterans are in their 70s and their 80s. Many have been denied and have not appealed because they looked to their colleagues and knew that it would be in vain. Many have never come to the VA for similar reasons. Many have continued to fight, like Mr. Score, and yet they continue to be denied. It's extraordinary that Mr. Score has been fighting for 40 years for his benefits. He's asking that this court allow him to continue fighting, not just for him, but for others as he moves forward. With regard to the Secretary's particular due process concerns, on a practical level, these are not veterans who are typically represented. These are not veterans who would typically be able to bring these sorts of claims before this court. However, appellant has brought them. And as this
Why
court,
not?
Sorry?
Why not?
Just as a practical matter, Your Honor, just in terms of representation, just in terms of their age. I'm not saying that they could not, but simply as far as the equities are concerned, this is perhaps the best chance that they might get, particularly in the near future. And with regard to whether class certification is appropriate here in particular, in Monk, this court looked to a line of cases starting in Walmart and then through Tyson Foods and then through Parsons to explain that class proceedings are appropriate when the class targets specific policies or practices that allegedly violate the law. And that is what appellant's legal challenges are.
So what would your position be about, to follow up on Judge Bartley's point, it seems to me that the Secretary has conceded that if the right temporal limitation is imposed, at least under the 3.311 claim or issue, that the requirements of at least commonality, typicality, adequacy, et cetera, are satisfied. What's your position about the temporal scope issue?
Your Honor, we would not object to the temporal limitations that the Secretary has conceded to if this court were determined that they were necessary. It is correct that the Labatt-Anderson report, the Secretary first started to rely upon it around 2001, and then in the 309 context, the law that underlies the 309 list of radiation risk activities was passed in 1984. So to the extent that those limitations are appropriate, we would agree. With regard to another point the Secretary raised, this is a case that can be decided on the papers that the appellant has put before the court. This court did recognize in its Monk case that in the class certification context, the court may engage in some limited fact-finding on questions that pertain to the class on the whole. The attachments that appellant includes in his merits briefing are designed to do that. The Secretary has not challenged whether these policies went to all Palomares veterans' claims. It's the case that they have. And those attachments attached for the convenience of the court do enable this court to look to them in the class cert context to the extent that there are questions about things like numerosity or commonality or anything like that.
Well, let's say that that's accurate and we agree with you. What happens then, though, when we get to the merits, if we were to disagree that we could no longer look at those documents at that point?
Your Honor, the vast majority of the attachments that the appellant has included, this court...
I'm going to say, let's just assume that we've decided we're not taking judicial notice, that they weren't before the veteran, and the veteran hadn't filed them before the agency. If we're just going to say we're not going to look at these past the class certification point, mm-hmm. Does that create a problem for you that we've now relied on some documents for limited purposes, but then now we can't look at them for the merits?
No, Your Honor. In the 311 context, as Judge Allen has noted, Mr. Score did raise that the Secretary's methodology that it was using to adjudicate his and his fellow Palomares veterans' claims was arbitrary and capricious. The Secretary is obliged by its own regulations to rely on sound scientific evidence in adjudicating any veteran's claim under 311. By failing to address that concern and by failing to address that challenge, the Secretary would concede that he did not rely upon sound scientific evidence.
What's your position on what the Secretary's counsel said about the board really no obligation at all to even address that argument in terms of the sound scientific evidence? It had no obligation to sort of dig in and weigh anything.
We would disagree. In the case of Hilker v. West, this court did, it wasn't squarely on this issue, but this court did look to the sound scientific evidence prong of the 311 regulation, and it said that it is an obligation for the secretary to rely upon it. And here, where appellant has raised it, and where it's been at issue for so many years, the secretary was under an obligation to look to it and to address the concern below.
But, I mean, one of the things we were asking your colleague earlier is about maybe the utility of certifying a class when a precedential decision will sort of do the trick. Mm-hmm. And I'm questioning even the sort of foundation of that, if it's an open question, if we could even issue a precedential decision in the first place. And does that speak to your sort of class calculus?
To a bit, Your Honor. So first, we can address any sort of fact-finding on that question at the merits. Actually, I'm sorry, could you restate the question?
The logic behind aggregation, Rama, mm-hmm. is it's easier and more, there are certain big ticket items that are just more efficient to adjudicate, mm-hmm. you know, as one-off things rather than have thousands of people raise huge claims that require huge evidentiary records. And so here, it's an open question. I mean, counsel did not at all concede that this is even something that when Mr. Score wrote these letters and raised these questions, that he was even entitled to a decision on that, and that the board had to even compile an evidentiary record, that this really, that we would even have any jurisdiction to even look into this question. Because that to me seems like, that makes a lot of this class stuff kind of a red herring. If it's the question, that's the question that really, you know, I'm kind of drilling down on. And then, you know, I just wanted to hear your position on that, because you know, earlier it seemed to be conceded that, okay, well, a precedential decision will kind of do the trick. But based on the government's position, I don't even know if we can get a precedential opinion.
Your Honor, so first we disagree that a precedential decision would be efficient here or desirable to achieve the remedies that appellant seeks, and I'll get back to that in a moment. However, the Federal Circuit did recognize in the Maggott case that this court can hear legal challenges in the first instance here. And so if the board failed to consider Mr. Score's legal challenges below, we would argue that those challenges were implicitly denied in the board's April 2017 decision.
Ms. Brooks, your response really is almost directed at questions that I've asked. If I understand Judge Toth's question, mm-hmm. it's we simply may not have jurisdiction to address this, period, because the board can't answer this question. So I don't want to put words into Judge Toth's mouth, but I think that's what he's asking you to respond to. Mm-hmm. And I'd sort of like your response to that, too, because I'll tell you, I think the board had an obligation to respond to this. But that's what's separating, I think, Judge Toth and me right now, and so this is an important moment in the argument to get your mm-hmm. your position on that.
Yeah, so stop me from going down the wrong track. But this court has jurisdiction over appellant's claim under 7252A. So appellant has been denied before the board. And in Maggott, it's determined that this court has the ability to hear legal challenges in the first instance. Under this court's scope of review under 7261, this court can decide all relevant questions of law that are raised. This court can further hold actions not just of the board but also of the secretary to be arbitrary and capricious, and this court can set aside unlawful decisions. And so that's what we're asking this court to do. And with regard to whether a presidential decision would affect that end, the answer is no, not really, particularly if appellant were to prevail on his claims. The board, as was sort of discussed below, does not have the authority to order re-adjudication. The board further does not have the authority, because it is a creature of, because it's bound by regulation, to hold the secretary's decision not to include Palomares in the list of radiation risk activities is arbitrary and capricious and otherwise unlawful.
So let's stop on that one. So if the board, if the board doesn't have the authority to do that, then at least as to the 3.309 issue, mm-hmm. then requiring the board to say anything about that is meaningless, right?
Perhaps, Your Honor.
Well, what do you mean, perhaps? If the board can't, if the board doesn't have the authority to do it, then what would be the what would be the utility of sending it back to them to talk about it?
Your Honor, we would argue that first, if there were any sort of remand, that it be very time limited because of the efficiency and equity concerns at issue in this case. If, however, Congress established this court to answer legal questions that pertain to the Secretary's denial of disability benefits claims.
Well, actually, Congress established the court to provide review for final decisions of the Board of Veterans' Appeals.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the Board of Veterans' Appeals can't decide something, then it doesn't get to us, right?
That's one point of view.
Yes, that is one point of view. No. So if the appellant has raised a 309 challenge and has said that it is arbitrary and capricious for the Secretary to continue to exclude Palomares from the list of radiation risk activities, and this board has not answered it, this court still has the jurisdiction and the authority to answer the question. If remand were to occur, that question would still come back up to this court eventually for a decision on the law as it pertains.
And in giving that answer, are you parsing the language used in 7261 that includes not only the board but the secretary? Or how are you coming to that conclusion? I don't need to lead you. I'm just saying, I'm trying to figure out like how you're getting there. And I note that, you know, of course there's 7252, which requires a board decision, but there's also 7261, which says in any action brought under this chapter, the court, to the extent necessary to its decision and when presented, shall. Now, I don't know that we've ever decided what when presented means. Anyway, it talks about the secretary and the board in those sections as two different entities.
Correct.
So are you relying on that, or are you relying on something else whenever you gave the answer to Judge Allen?
Yes, Your Honor, we would be relying on that. So that would be 7261A3, which does permit this court to hold unlawful and set aside decisions, findings, conclusions, rules and regulations issued or adopted by the Secretary, and then it lays out grounds among which are arbitrary and capricious, contrary to constitutional right, and in excess of and without observance of procedure required by law. So any of those grounds would be applicable.
So if we were to hold that the board wasn't obligated to kind of dig into the methodology or competent or whatnot, and then we had no jurisdiction, the only recourse would be to petition for rulemaking. Is there any other court anywhere that a petitioner, as relates to a veteran, as relates to that veteran's claim, could challenge sort of methodology?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. However, to require the veteran to file a petition for rulemaking and then wait on that before the VA and then to appeal that to the Federal Circuit and go through that whole litigation process simply would not provide the sort of it would almost be moot. It would prevent the delivery of the relief that's needed here. And as the Supreme Court and this court has recognized, veterans' benefits are crucial with regard to both the fact that veterans worked for them and served for them, and that Congress intends veterans to have them. And with regard, again, to the...
Actually, if I can interject, I have a question. Your opposing counsel said that the requirement that for a final board decision is jurisdictional, thus distinguishing Bowen and some of those other cases sitting here. What is your response to that?
Our response is that this court does have jurisdiction over a final board decision. That being...
Right, but when there is no final board decision,
mm-hmm.
then he is asserting that we don't have jurisdiction. That is not a waivable argument, I mean a waivable requirement.
To the extent that you're talking about class members?
Yes.
So this court has jurisdiction over Mr. Score's denial. And then in the Henderson case, the Supreme Court noted that the sorts of finality considerations in for example, like the Rule 121-day deadline that's present is not, in fact, jurisdictional. It's simply a rule of procedure. Further, in the Maggott case, the Federal Circuit ruled that exhaustion, too, is discretionary. And in the district court context, federal courts waive finality and exhaustion, particularly in future class injunctive cases, all the time.
Your opposing counsel asserts that Henderson specifically held that the final board decision portion of 7252, as opposed to the 120-day requirement in 7252, is not waivable and is jurisdictional. Well, they didn't say not waivable. They said jurisdictional, I believe, was his argument. So to me, asserting that Maggott requires no exhaustion, that's exhaustion regarding arguments, not exhaustion regarding final decision by the agency.
We would disagree with the Secretary's reading of the case. The 120-day deadline, we read the case to say that it is, in fact, not jurisdictional.
Right, and with regard to 120 days.
Right, and if it were read jurisdictionally, it would clash with the solicitude of Congress in ensuring that veterans are provided benefits.
And also that it was more of a claim processing type of a rule or statute of limitations. But the requirement for a final board decision is a distinct requirement from that one. And so that's specifically what I'm asking you about.
Certainly, Your Honor. So this court can look to claims that it would prospectively have jurisdiction over under the All Writs Act. And those would be claims whether at the RO, whether before the board, or whether they have not yet been filed. Because any of those claims could, going through the process, eventually make their way up to this court to be decided on their own merits.
Your argument is that we're not waiving the finality of board decision requirement. It's that we're comboing with the All Writs Act for the folks that don't have a final board decision.
In essence, Your Honor. It would look similar to, for example...
Your professor's nodding.
Yes. Yes. In essence, it would look similar to what happened in the Califano case. It's been brought up many times. There was a mixture of exhausted and non-exhausted claims. Similarly, the U.S. Supreme Court held in Albemarle that mixed exhausted and unexhausted class actions are permissible, particularly.
So what would make a case that in some decisions, in these like Social Security contexts, and they found that there must be finality, or the Pitson case that Judge Allen mentions, and in other cases they have not found, what would make our case more like City of New York and less like Pitson?
So there are a few things, Your Honor. So first, with regard to Weinberger, for example, there it was a specific statutory jurisdictional limitation that the court found didn't allow it to proceed with jurisdiction. However, the key defining feature between this court and between the district courts that employ Rule 23b2, for example, is that this court is driven by a pro-veteran ethic. It's driven by the need to ensure that veterans receive the benefit of the doubt, and it's driven by Congress's desire that all eligible veterans do, in fact, receive their benefits. And so the legal challenges that appellant is bringing today seek to remove threshold issues, threshold barriers in all of his fellow class members' claims. This is something that this court can grant and should grant, and Mr. Score asks that this court do so on behalf of not just him, but those veterans who would come after. I see my time is up.
Good.
Are you saying that for those veterans who have never filed a claim, don't have to file a claim?
Your Honor, we are saying that were they to file a claim in the future, then the injunctive relief that appellant seeks would protect them. And in fact, when, again, the advisory committee was looking to Rule 23b2 back in 1966, it noted that injunctive relief in future class actions may be appropriate where even one or only a few class members have already suffered harm. And so, just like there, this is also a situation where injunctive relief on a class-wide basis would be appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted for consideration. The court will now come down and recounsel.
All rise.